walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and today on the show, we're doing something different. Setting aside our regular format in favor of convening a panel discussion about service animals. Have you ever been to the grocery store or a restaurant or on an airplane and spotted an animal sporting a vest suggesting it's a service animal, but having doubts for one reason or another that it is a service animal? Maybe even in some cases thinking that this couldn't possibly be an animal that could be passed off as a service animal. That scenario reflects one of the concerns over the growing use of bogus service animals that constitutes a core of today's discussion. But to properly examine the issue, we'll seek to address a myriad of topics, among them the various categories of service animals, particularly as defined under the Americans with Disabilities Act, including the differences in how the animals are trained, what duties they can perform, and where. We'll get to that discussion and meet our panelists in a moment here on Talk Animals. First, though, I must take a moment to discuss WMNF's Winter Fun Drive, which begins tomorrow. Talking Animals has a towering fundraising goal. I've been asked to raise $3,000 on my show in less than an hour. 55 minutes. Yikes. So the only process I have of making that $3,000 goal is to receive pledges and donations before that fun drive show. How about now? Now, while I'd love for you to donate in support of Talking Animals, simply because you appreciate the work we do here on the program and all the interviews and other elements of the show each week, we do have exclusive Talking Animals thank you gifts for donations of various levels, including fantastic tickets to see Willie Nelson March 4th at Ruth Eckert Hall, a show all but sold out, a special deal on a week-long stay at a condo on the Hawaiian island of Kauai, tickets to see David Cross of HBO's Mr. Show with Bob and David in Arrested Development, and a veteran top-notch stand-up comic, copies of the latest books by Dr. Carl Safina and Tracy Stewart, signed by the authors, and many more thank you gifts that you can only receive by donating in support of Talking Animals. Please head to talkinganimals.net for all the details and fast, easy ways you can pledge early. Early, I tell you. We have early bird specials, in fact, for many of those thank you gifts. So, right now, though, let's meet our panelists. Martha Johnson is the Public Relations Coordinator for the Southeast Region of Canine Companions for Independence, or CCI, which provides highly trained assistance dogs and ongoing support to people with disabilities. CCI has been very active in the area of education regarding legitimate versus not-so-legitimate service dogs. Joanne Miles is something of an activist in this realm, chiefly in response to issues that have arisen for her husband Ken, who became blind in 2001 and uses a guide dog named Marty from Southeastern Guide Dogs. Linda Feld has a rare form of muscular dystrophy, is a graduate of the Canine Companions for Independence program, and as of 2012 has been living with her service dog Keith. And Roberta has been a flight attendant with a commercial airline for the better part of 30 years, participating openly in this discussion would, I understand, that constitute grounds for immediate dismissal from the airline, so she has to speak with a certain degree of anonymity, but she has tremendous experience with airline passengers accompanied by both authentic and maybe not-so-authentic service dogs, and we'll share some of those stories. So, good morning, Martha, Joanne, Linda, and Roberta. Are we all here?
We are all here.
We're here.
Good okay.
Good morning.
Sorry, I didn't have Roberta on. She's in studio. The rest of you guys are on phone, I should point out to our listeners. So, Martha, I'd like to start by asking kind of the pivotal question, I think, for this morning. What is a service animal? What constitutes a service animal?
Well, I'm just going by the Americans with Disabilities definition of a service animal, and they define a service animal as a dog and that has been trained to do work or perform tasks for a person with a disability, and the task performed by the dog must directly relate to the person's disability.
Also, crucially for our purposes this morning, what are the categories of service animals and the characteristics of each that might distinguish them?
Well, I'm going to speak to Canine Companions and the dogs we provide. We primarily focus on physical and developmental disabilities. So in our case, we have a category called service. That is Linda Feld has a service dog, and they work with an adult with a physical disability. They're generally, they could be in a wheelchair. They need the dog to help them with physical tasks of daily living. We have a category for children called Skilled Companion. That's a child, and they work with an adult who helps them handle the dog. Again, that child might be someone with cerebral palsy, spina bifida. Again, they need the dog to help them with tasks for daily living. We also have hearing dogs that help someone who is deaf or hard of hearing and alert them to key sounds. And then we have facility dogs, and those are dogs that work with an able-bodied person who work in facilities that serve clients with special needs.
Okay, so those are, again, very specific roles and all based on, of course, your earlier definition, require extensive and serious training.
Exactly.
So does training really, for our conversation today, kind of constitute the real difference, not only the dogs that you mentioned in the categories that CCI tends to work with, but just generally, is that what is going to prove to be the difference between some of the dogs we talk about that may be in the news lately? And I don't know, if, by the way, if how many of you might have happened to see the piece on the Today Show just this morning about emotional service animals on airplanes and sort of how people are gaming the system there. Did anyone happen to see that?
I did not see that, but Canine Companion is one of our statements is in this campaign to what we call Stop Fraud, is the vest doesn't make the service dog, the training does. So that's the key thing that really plays the big role here is the training. And when you see a dog who is wearing the vest but is not properly trained, is maybe pulling on the leash, is barking, is not under control, then that's your key indicator that is not a service dog.
And again, by the way, I'm sort of directing some of these questions to specific people, but I invite all of you to jump in at any moment to expand on a point or comment or disagree with one, especially one of mine that I might make. So don't anybody be shy. But the vest thing, Martha, I was in sort of doing the research for this, I was struck that while the vest would seem kind of all important both for legitimate and sort of more bogus animals that we're sort of discussing today, it seems like under the laws of the ADA, the vest is not actually required to be worn. But I guess I'm curious for, again, anyone who would like to answer, why someone would opt not to put the vest on their animals.
Well, sometimes the dog might have an aversion to the vest.
Okay.
We do have some cases where we have a dog who is has met all our criteria, who's gone through the 2 years of training, and they just have an aversion to that vest. That's the only thing that is not going to allow them to be a working assistance dog. So we would still place that dog with, and in our case, we do like our dogs to be identified, and they may have a bandana instead of the vest. But there are cases where the dog may have an aversion to wearing a vest. But you're correct. The ADA does not require that a service dog has to wear a vest to be identified as a service dog.
Right, but if I follow what you're saying is if in the course of the CCI program, if a dog does have that aversion to wearing a vest, then that dog would be redirected into another kind of work, right? That dog wouldn't necessarily be a working CCI dog if they were not able to wear the vest.
Correct. Only about, in our situation, only about 50% of our dogs make it through the entire program because we do have our standards are very high. So only about 50% of our dogs make it all the way through to become a working assistance dog like Keith, who Linda has.
Yeah.
They can be released back to the puppy raiser's home, and that puppy raiser may use them for some other therapy work because they're obviously going to be wonderful, excellently trained dogs, but they're not going to be a working assistance dog.
I gotcha. So, Linda, as someone who has gone through the fairly rigorous process to be paired with a dog from CCI, and of course, Keith himself has gone through an extremely rigorous process of training, how do you react when you see people with quote-unquote service animals that you suspect are not authentic?
Well, I don't confront the people. That's not my position to take. We have had that happen to us, and Keith is so well trained. He stands there and he just kind of looks at the dog as though, why are you doing that? Why are you misbehaving in public? He doesn't react in any way to a dog barking at him or lunging at him. But it has happened to us in various businesses and things like that. We have seen dogs that were in the stores as service dogs who just had a little medallion hanging from their collar. But Keith is trained to not react, and you know he knows that he can't hurt me in any way. So by pulling on the lead or trying to get to this other dog, he knows that he can't do that. Keith is trained, if I say sit, Keith sits and is totally quiet and just lets the other dog pass by.
And it also sounds like he's a bit puzzled by why this other dog is misbehaving that way. So I'm with Keith, by the way.
Keith is very smart, and sometimes I think he looks at that dog as though you should go to school, too.
Yeah. Well, so, Joanne, this sort of brings me to something. We chatted a little bit in preparation for this morning's show, and one of the things I think I remember you saying is that one of the concerns about the sort of more bogus service dogs is that they can, in some cases, be disruptive to, like, let's say, your husband's dog and affect the job the dog is intended to do. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, when we were in the grocery store once, and, you know, Marty was with us, and we're walking along, and all of a sudden there's a lady with a little dog in the grocery cart, and the dog just starts barking and snarling and, you know, distracting Marty from doing his job because this other dog is just so disruptive. I mean, it's obvious that, you know, the dog was not trained to do anything, and people are not informed that emotional support dogs are not service dogs. They should not be out in public. They're only for your housing. And, I mean, I've also had people, we went to a restaurant once, and the girl in the restaurant said, "Oh, is that a service dog?" And Marty had his harness on. And we said, "Yes, he's a guide dog." "Well, where's his vest?" I mean, the general public is just so misinformed and uneducated about this, it seems like it'll take forever to get this straightened out.
Well, we're taking a modest step in that direction, I hope, this morning, Joanne. But see, that's just it. I think there's so many blurred lines about what really qualifies a dog to do that kind of work. And meanwhile, part of the reason I guess I wanted to have this conversation today is that it seems to me there's some sort of growing trend of, again, bogus, I'll just use that word, animals in this regard, and people sort of gaming the system. This could, any or all of you could answer this. I mean, why do you think that's the case? What may have triggered it? And later we'll get into hopefully some things that maybe can be done about it.
I was just going to say that a lot of these vests are now available on the internet. You can go and buy these vests at multiple sites on the internet. And I think people have just gotten wise to the idea that people with a service dog are allowed to take this dog into many locations that they aren't allowed to take their pet. So they're trying to circumnavigate the system, and it's become very easy.
Yeah, well, again, for those who didn't see this morning's piece on the Today Show, the focus of that was emotional service animals on flights, and a key part of that story was that all of it's done online, and that how easy it is. You kind of go online, you answer a few questions, you pay your money, and the next thing you know, you have a letter generated from some sort of mental health professional who you've never met with and has never seen your animal, and you're in business. So, and then part of the piece, investigative reporter Jeff Rossin brought his dog on, tried that, getting certified or getting the paperwork at least this way, and then later had his producer try to get a pig on, and again got the paperwork, and you see her taking two different flights with the pig on her lap. So I guess part of what I wonder about is there no legislation in place, or as we often find in the animal welfare world, is there just too much toothless legislation, and or just enforcement is proving to be too difficult?
All the above.
Yeah, all the above. Some states have passed state laws. In fact, Florida just passed a state law making it a misdemeanor to portray your dog as a service animal when the dog is not. But the second part of that, as you said, is the enforcement. So as Linda mentioned, the one of the biggest problems are these companies that sell the vest online. That's really that make it so easy to get that fake vest and to get a letter. So some of the states are looking at this, and I a number of states have passed that law, but it's the enforcement that is tends to be the challenge.
One thing, too, I noticed in terms of the fairly new state law here in Florida that's been implemented to sort of deal with those who falsely claim a pet as a service animal. And I say deal with because as opposed to punish, because I think it's a second degree misdemeanor, even if they do try to enforce it. So, I mean, an actual slap on the wrist might hurt more than that.
Right, exactly.
So let's get Roberta involved in this because I wanted to have her on partly because, again, it seems like a lot of times this issue pops up in the media, like today with the Today Show piece or on social media related to flights and certain animals that are in the news or pictures of them go viral. So, Roberta, maybe you could talk to us a little bit about what you see after almost 30 years of flying. I mean, can you immediately tell when an animal boards the plane that they are an actual service animal as opposed to one that you think, okay, this, what's going on here?
Absolutely. I've never seen a legitimate service animal that wasn't 100% focused on their owner, first of all. It's very hard to get the attention of a service dog, if you've ever tried. They're so focused on their owner, and they're very businesslike. They know exactly what they're doing when they get on that plane. Whereas many of these fake scam artists that bring on these animals, you can tell by the animal's demeanor. And we're not just talking about dogs, by the way. I'm shocked to find out that the ADA says that only dogs, is that what I heard? Only dogs are
Martha, is it dogs? And why do I think it's like
it's
miniature horses?
It's dogs and miniature horses.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all?
That's all that's confined. And that changed several years ago. Prior to that, it was broader.
Okay.
But I believe it changed in 2012 to only define dogs and miniature horses.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting that it sounds like the ADA is trying to narrow this and make their own efforts in this regard. But I guess I find it interesting that in addition to dogs, that miniature horses would be the one other animal. Can anybody on the panel kind of speak to why miniature horses would be the only other one officially allowed under the ADA law?
I have no idea myself.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm right to be mystified then.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
I can tell you that my airline's policy includes dogs, cats, and certain birds.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm surprised to find that really the ADA only recognizes dogs, and that's good for me to know.
Mm-hmm.
But we also go on a case-by-case basis, and this is where it gets kind of crazy. I just was polling some of my coworkers about animals that they've had on board that were considered emotional support animals, and I can give you a couple of examples if
Please,
you want me to tell
you. By all means, yeah.
One of them was a friend of mine had a monkey on board, and the monkey threw back the peanut bag at my friend that was offered to the passenger. And then my friend was afraid to offer a drink to the passenger because he didn't want to end up wearing the drink. Another friend of mine had a rooster on a leash, considered an emotional support animal. She actually asked jokingly, you know, if the rooster was going to crow when the sun came up, and the passenger said no, they'd had its vocal cords removed.
That's two times wacky, perhaps.
Yeah. So, and then another friend talked about having a sugar glider on board, and the passenger pulled the sugar glider out of her bra and offered to let my friend pet the sugar glider. So these are all things that happen literally on a daily basis on the airplanes that I fly on. This never happened until, I'd say, within the past 2 years, and now it's so rampant. It's constant, and we are forbidden to ask any questions, of course.
That's one of the things that's interesting, and I'm glad you're sort of marking, because one of the things I was trying to get at, to the extent that it could be described, is when that what just seems like now a rampant trend would be marked. So you were saying a couple of years or so, at least in terms of flights. But
sure.
But the other thing that I think we all have difficulties, either you're prohibited by your airline, some of us are maybe prohibited by social protocol or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Of asking mm-hmm. people. So you, no matter what, no matter how suspicious or nutso it might seem, you cannot ask anyone to show their documentation, their paperwork, or anything about that animal once
Absolutely
they board the plane.
Not.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. And the only question that we are allowed to ask is, what service does this dog provide for you? That's to help us, because,
sure.
For instance, I had a a service dog on a flight about a year ago with a veteran, and he was prone to seizures. So I asked him what the service was that the dog provided. He said, the dog will bark constantly if I'm about to have a seizure. If he does that, please reach in my bag, pull out the medication, and give it to me. So that's the only question I can ask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But even that, I mean, that's very helpful.
It's extremely helpful.
Yeah, because I don't see how that guy could comfortably get on board that flight without having you or a fellow flight attendant know.
Sure.
Because if the seizure does happen, it's one thing for the dog to alert, but if nobody gets him that medicine, we're in
Absolutely.
Trouble.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one thing I will say, when people are doing this in the wrong way, it really takes my attention off of people who legitimately need my help on the airplane, and that bothers me. It's disconcerting to know that someone is saying they've got an emotional support animal just to duck out of, no pun intended, just to duck out of having their pet confined in a kennel that goes under the seat and paying the fee that is involved with that.
Yeah.
It's a way to not have to pay money to transport your animal.
Well, that certainly seemed to be at least part of the theme of the piece this morning on the Today Show, is that they see at least the escalation of this tied to exactly that. People have to pay a certain fee to have their pets on the flight. So if they get the vest, through whatever means, they don't have to pay a fee, and then the animal rides right with them. So
sure.
There's a couple pluses there. You know, I guess I'm wondering about the legislation, and again, the state law in Florida, just as I think we've kind of addressed, I guess it's nice that it's there, but it doesn't sound like from anybody's standpoint on the panel that it's really made much of a difference, nor that it's likely to. Is that a reasonable assessment?
Yeah, well, one thing that's very confusing to the public is that the airlines allow the emotional support pets on the plane,
mm-hmm.
where they are not service animals.
Right.
They are not considered service animals. They are only for like apartment buildings and a no pet place where you can bring your dog in. They're not supplied the access that service dogs are under the ADA. They are just for your home. But the airline confuses a lot of things, too, when they let the people bring these animals on board and say they're emotional, you know, support animals, and then everybody thinks that they're service animals.
Correct. That's the air travel is covered under the Air Carrier Access Act. So mm-hmm. And that's where they do allow emotional support animals on air travel.
Yes.
And again, you're supposed to have a letter from a physician, which, of course, as we've heard, you can get just by, you know, getting it online. But right, that does create confusion, because then under the ADA, emotional support animals do not fall under the public access.
Right.
Hmm.
It's very confusing to the general public.
It is very confusing. I'm so thrilled to hear this, because it helps me, it just helps me understand, and maybe I can present that to my company as reason to be more cautious about what animals are being allowed on the planes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, check out the Air Carrier Access Act.
Mm-hmm.
Let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, I'm conducting a panel discussion about service animals of one kind or another. And our panel includes Martha Johnson from Canine Companions for Independence, Joanne Miles, who's become something of an activist in this realm tied to issues that have arisen for her husband, who is blind and uses a guide dog from Southeastern Guide Dogs, Linda Feld, who has a form of muscular dystrophy, is a graduate of the Canine Companions for Independence program, paired with her service dog, Keith, and Roberta, flight attendant with a commercial airline for nearly 30 years. We're probably now going to try to invite some listeners to ask a question or offer a comment. If you'd like to do that, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. And so one thing that I find interesting in the midst of sort of the legislation and the struggles with that is, on the other hand, policies to kind of root out bogus service animals can have unintended, if not ironic, consequences. Joanne, maybe you could kind of speak to the situation that you and your husband experienced recently that fits that exact description.
Yes, that recently I received in the mail the application for Marty to get his rabies shot and the tag from Palm Beach County Animal Control. And I noticed on the application they didn't have the little box in there for the service dogs. So I called up, and I was transferred to a company in Texas who takes care of this, the licensing for animal control. And he says, we were just told that there's no more more free tags for the service people, for the service dogs. So that sort of irked me a little. So I wrote to my county commissioner, who then got in touch with Animal Control, and the woman from Animal Control, Diane Suave, said that they stopped it because there were too many people buying things online, and they couldn't tell the service dogs from the fraudulent dogs, so they stopped this this nice gesture they had to help out the handicapped and all the veterans, you know, just take that little thing away from them. And without trying to resolve the problem, I says, all you'd have to do is get a note from an accredited school with your, you know, and turn it in. I say, because it's becoming a big problem, but it was just left at that. So I don't know if anything else is going to happen, but that nobody is willing. I mean, this is a county employee that I asked, you know, don't turn a blind eye on this. It's the law. And still, they just, you know, that's it. They're not going to pursue it, and they're not going to issue the free tags. The whole thing isn't the free tags. It's the fraudulent dogs that are out there that are disrupting the service dogs.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the point. It's hurting legitimate people. Like, and you just, you don't know what these people are thinking when they do that, how they are hurting people who legitimately need these dogs to help them have independence.
Mm-hmm. Part of the reason I wanted to invite Joanne to be part of this is I read about this kind of my side of the state, and I just thought, well, this is now we're not only not addressing the problem, we're punishing people who are doing everything right. And your husband, again, has been blind for a number of years, has a guide dog from Southeastern Guide. I mean, it couldn't be more legitimate across the board, and yet somehow you guys are penalized by all the people that have gamed the system.
Exactly. Oh,
and also, Duncan, I know with my airline, we have a quota of how many service animals can be on a flight at time. So if someone's taking up that slot with an animal that's not a legitimate service animal, might be prohibiting
someone
from getting on
that
plane.
Flight. So I guess obviously all these arrangements were made in advance, and people indicate that they're flying with an animal.
Absolutely.
And then what is that quota, out of curiosity?
Well, what's coming to my mind right now is 4.
Okay.
Now, again, I'm sure on a case-by-case basis something could be done about that, but that is, I mean, that's policy, so.
Yeah, interesting, yeah. All right, well, let's, we've got at least one, some callers and emailers here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals, so did you have a comment or a question for our panel?
Is it me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, listen, maybe you covered this, but I'm wondering, as a fellow airline passenger, how do you take into account the person sitting next to that person? Because if I have a dog phobia or a cat allergy or a fear of roosters, how in the heck do you stick somebody with an animal next to somebody on a plane? How do you see people?
That's an excellent question. We have, like I would say, on a daily basis, I have passengers come to me and say, I am terrified of dogs. I have allergies to dogs. So that's going to take time away from basically from my safety duties, which is what I'm trying to focus on when I'm boarding an airplane. It takes time for me to have to try to figure out how to reseat that passenger. And it causes quite a stir when you're trying to move people around. And it's very difficult sometimes to find a passenger who is willing to sit next to an animal. Personally, I'm not really sure I'd want to sit next to a bird. I'm not a big fan of birds, and especially uncaged. So it's a legitimate fear, and it does it does cause a lot of hassle just about every time we have an animal on board. Now, like I said earlier, you know the legitimate service dogs. You know them because they are so calm and so focused and so behaved. But I've had dogs growl at me, dogs snap at me, or, you know, other passengers. And there's also sometimes a little hygiene issue because some passengers will put their dogs on their tray tables or, you know, wedge them between the passenger next to them. And it's not necessarily something that other passenger appreciates.
Well, my daughter caught psittacosis from a friend's bird when we took their bird. And then a dog. I've seen dogs in shopping carts or even carrier basket in the store. And I think, I'd really like to tell the store to approach the person. You know, you can love your dog, but I know the dog was walking on the ground and could have worms, and I'm putting my lettuce in the same basket.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for your answer.
Thank you for your call. And while we're on the subject of birds and things, I mean, been wanting to do this kind of show for some time, and again, it's not I can't wish I could take credit as it being my own idea, but it was a suggestion. But the catalyst to make it happen today was the recent, I guess a couple weeks ago or so, I guess now the news, and the picture went viral of the turkey on the flight. And again, I posted about that just by way of trying to promote the show and let people know about today's show. And a couple of people sort of defended the turkey and said that that was a legitimate emotional support animal. So again, the boundaries of this seem to be very blurry. With that in mind, I want to read an email that just came in. This says, emotional support animals are not all bogus. I have agoraphobia. Having my dog with me enables me to leave the house and yes, even to fly. The fact that one cannot see a disability doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I just want to underscore, if it wasn't clear, that we weren't suggesting here, I wasn't, and I don't think anyone on the panel is, that by virtue of having an emotional support animal, it's a suspect or bogus. I think what we're talking about is probably, unlike the emailer here, people who are just going online, getting a certificate, claiming to have their pet be an emotional support animal, and with various repercussions that we've, some of which we've already heard about.
And claiming to have a disability.
Yeah.
Correct, absolutely. There's we serve many people with what we call invisible disabilities. The hearing dogs are one. One example, you can't detect that someone has the hearing disability. So they do struggle. They, because of this issue with the fake service dog, people are questioning them now about their use of this dog when, yes, they need that dog. So no, we're not emotional support dogs if they actually have a very important role and help people a lot. It's the people who are using fake service dogs.
It's interesting you would say that. In a sort of odd serendipitous development with this panel of mine, I was at Publix on Monday, and I saw a woman shopping with sort of, I'm not quite sure, it was sort of a German Shepherd mix, something else, but wearing a vest and just sort of ambling along next to her shopping cart. So even though I'm not quite sure what the protocol is about asking people, and I want to get back to that into a sec, but I did politely ask her what sort of service dog this was, and she answered, I take sudden falls, explaining that her dog Roscoe alerts and prevents her from falling. I gotta confess, I'm not quite clear, because if she started to fall, how Roscoe would prevent that. I could see how he could alert to that, but how he would prevent the fall. But anyway, she was very, very nice and gracious about it. But I mean, I'm not clear. Again, that's sort of one of those hidden things that reminds me of what you just explained there, Martha. But mm-hmm. I don't know what category that falls into.
Well, one of the questions you can ask is, what work or task has the dog been trained to perform?
Mm-hmm.
So, it's, again, a vague question, but I wanted to also remind everyone that business owners can ask a dog to leave if the dog is not mm-hmm. behaving properly. So if the dog and the handler is not taking any sort of action to try and correct the bad behavior. So if the dog is barking a lot, they can ask the dog to leave. If the dog is eating food off the floor, if the dog is not attuned to that person they're with, like they were saying earlier, that needs to be their focus. So a business can ask a dog to leave if the dog is not behaving properly.
I don't guess that applies to airplanes.
Yeah. Watch that first step. It's a doozy. Yeah. For sure.
And you're sort of trapped.
The airplanes did that to themselves by allowing the emotional support dogs. Emotional support dogs are only allowed in...
Hold on. I think...
Trained to be invisible. When I got Keith, they said, your dog is going to be invisible. And I don't mean that he's literally invisible.
Yeah.
But he makes himself so unknown.
Right.
That when I'm in a restaurant, he is in, a corner laying on the floor, never make a move to look for crumbs or anything like that under the table, never bark.
Mm-hmm.
Can go anywhere.
Right, and I think that's probably exactly the kind of focus that Roberta was referring to, immediately telegraphing. I don't know if you happen to fly with Keith, Linda, but again, whether it's Keith or another dog like Keith, I think that's what Roberta was saying. Like, immediately when that kind of dog comes on the plane, totally focused, there's no question what kind of dog we're looking at here. And yeah, I guess the more invisible in that regard, the better job that Keith is doing. This sort of overlaps an email that just, or a big long text that just came in. So it says, I still haven't heard a concise answer to how you deal with someone in a public or private, example, grocery situation, with an animal that is either disruptive, dangerous, or allergic. How can you prove that it's not legal, or how can you have them removed or prove prove to an official that an animal isn't a service animal and shouldn't be on a plane. If I'm allergic to a dog and the dog next to me is allergic or threatening, how do I have that dog removed if it's not ADA certified, etc.? It goes on from there. It's kind of a long question, but I think we've got the gist of it here. So I think, at least in terms of a flight, we've already established that you can't ask anything much other than just the basic thing, what service does that dog
perform? Correct. You could still ask those two questions.
And the fielding is really supposed to happen before the passenger boards the aircraft. So it's left to the gate agents to
make that determination.
To ask for that paperwork.
Okay.
Now, if they have paperwork, a gate agent isn't going to be able to say this is not legitimate paperwork, because there's a fear there of discriminating against someone who might actually...
And you're pretty far down the path if that passenger and that animal are about to board the plane. It's kind of hard probably at that point to say, whoa, we can't make this happen.
Right.
Exactly, right. It goes back to the issue we talked about before, this ability to get this information online so easily. That's where the problem really starts from. There has to be a way to regulate these online agencies who are issuing fake letters and fake vests.
And yeah. I've seen billboards outside of airports advertising for those services.
Well, and it's funny, in preparation for today's show, I was trying to do all kinds of research and try to figure out who would comprise the panel. So I found one organization, I think it's the National Service Registry or Service Animal Registry organization. And so I sent them an email and sort of said what I had in mind and didn't hear back. I thought that was weird. I followed up with a phone call, didn't hear back. I thought that was odd. And a couple more emails and phone calls. And I started to realize, okay, these are the very problem people. And this is why they don't want any part of this kind of discussion. So, but it was clear that from their website that these are people that I guess wouldn't have much trouble sending in your thing, never having any contact, never having your animal examined. And next, you know, you'd have a certificate or a vest or both.
In the condo here, this same place you were talking about, the Service Animal Registry of America, gave this woman that lived here a certificate saying that it was a service dog. It was the picture of a little tiny pug puppy. And I have the application right here. All you have to do is tell them, yes, I'm disabled. This is my service dog. Here's my picture. And then they have this disclaimer that they're not legally responsible for authorizing this and that. I mean, it's just totally bogus. All of these companies that sell the vest and everything else, they all have these large disclaimers that, you know, it's the information that you give them they go by, not by anything else. They're not authorizing anything. But I'll send you the papers for $45.
So I guess back to sort of an earlier question is, what steps can any of us who are talking about this and those listening to this, what steps can be taken? I mean, is there some sort of firmer legislation that could be put in place? Is there anything pending, Martha, or anyone else that's up on the panel that we could know about, that we could help support? Or what, you know, how do we take this forward so we really diminish this kind of trend?
Well, we have an online petition. It's at cci.org/stopfraud. And we've been trying to generate signatures on that petition so we can take that to our elected officials, both federal and state, and show them the impact that this is a large problem. And these are how many people are supporting us. It has about 50,000 signatures right now. And our chief executive officer, he was just recently in Washington, D.C., meeting with federal officials about this issue, just to open up the doors of discussion, try and come to a solution. We don't know what that solution is yet, but we're definitely trying to open those doors and make them aware that this is becoming a growing problem.
And in that case, Martha, is the idea just to collect as many signatures and say, look, this is a measure of how big the problem is, or is there specific kind of legislation that is being proposed as part of that petition?
Right now, it's just to show that this is a growing problem, and we just want to open up those doors of discussion.
Okay. And is there a certain number that you're hoping to get to before you say, okay, now we really are at the number where we think we can get their attention and get them to move on this?
Well, no. We're at 50,000 now. That's a large, significant
Absolutely.
Number.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think some people just have sort of targets for certain kinds of...
Actually, that was our target.
Oh, okay, good.
The petition is still open and online, and anyone can still sign it.
Okay. Okay, great. Well, we'll urge people to do that. So what does it really mean if an animal is certified in the legitimate realm? I think we've already established some of the things that can easily be done online to get something that doesn't seem to have any kind of roots in genuine circumstance. But what does that mean if an animal is certified, and how much does that mean to getting into places, onto flights, etc.?
Well, our dogs take 2 years of training before we feel they're at a point where they could go into public, and it's they're bred for that purpose. We have our own breeding program. We use certain breeds that are going to help our clients. The type of breeds we use are specifically would help the disabilities that our clients have. There are other breeds that are used for different disabilities. So ours is a two-year process to get them trained and to that point where we feel they can serve someone like Linda and help her.
Okay.
And then at that point, the dogs are matched very carefully with the human being who's going to be the partner of that dog. We don't know when we attend the two-week training class which dog that's going to be for us, but Canine Companions is extremely good at picking the right dog for you.
Yeah, making a love connection. Yeah.
And the other thing that we offer is that lifetime of support to the working dog. So should Linda have any concerns or problems with Keith, we're here to help her with that. And that's really important for a working service dog, to make sure that the match is going smoothly, there are no problems. We work with Linda on the lifetime that she has Keith.
I'm sorry about the feedback. I'm not really sure what the source of that is. But and I guess we should add, because I think, you know, having done shows about these kinds of dogs, I guess it's important to point out that these programs, Canine Companions for Independence, Southeastern Guide Dogs, provide those dogs to those people at no cost, right?
Correct.
Is pretty significant, given the incredible training and other things that have gone into getting that dog prepared to function in that way.
Correct.
So we're sort of in the final moment or two. This is, again, a panel discussion about service animals, and our panel includes Martha Johnson from Canine Companions for Independence, Joanne Miles, an activist tied to issues that have arisen for her husband, blind and used a guide dog from Southeastern Guide Dogs, Linda Feld, who has a form of muscular dystrophy, is a graduate of the Canine Companions for Independence program, paired with her service dog, Keith, and Roberta, flight attendant with Commercial Airline for nearly 30 years. So if we might have just a moment or two for any further calls or comments, 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So let's take another call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals.
Hi, is this me?
Yeah, you have a comment or question for our panel. Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I just wanted to ask, and perhaps you handled this while I was offline a minute ago, but what can people do who have legitimate emotional problems that need assistance, and perhaps an animal or a dog can help? Are there any circumstances that you can address where that's the situation? And I'll go offline and listen.
Well, one other quick question. Can you maybe cite a more specific example of what kind of help that person would be seeking?
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I didn't say it. If someone has a legitimate emotional incapacitation or disability,
okay,
is there anything they can do along these lines? That's it.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Anybody want on our panel? I think there's some stuff in the ADA things about that, but anyone, again, on the panel who would like to feel that?
I believe Southeastern has a program now for emotional support animals that are trained. However, they are not considered service dogs, but they will train them with people that have these problems. And being that they are not service dogs, they are not permitted out in the public. They don't have the public access like a service dog does. They're for your home or taking a walk with them or things like that.
Although, as you say that, Joanne, one thing that occurs to me, because we've done a bunch of different shows on related topics, and one was about a wing of the Southeastern Guide Dog Program, where they do train dogs specifically to work with veterans that have PTSD and other wounds of war. Yeah.
That would be a service dog, but it's called a psychiatric service dog. It's trained altogether differently than the emotional support dog.
Yeah, although I guess my sense, maybe I'm misremembering this, is that part of the very point of that training is indeed that those those dogs and the person can go out in public, because that's what people struggling with PTSD need the most. So
yes, exactly.
Correct. And let me just give an example about a PTSD dog. Is we're working with the VA right now on a study about dogs with PTSD for veterans with PTSD, because it is a big problem. And the case, in this case, they are performing a task. So our dogs, for example, are being trained to go into a darkened room, because they may have a fear of a dark room. They go into the darkened room. They alert them if there's anyone in the room. They can also turn on the light switch for them. So that's the difference there. And but as we've said before, the ADA, a dog that just provides comfort by being with the person, is not considered a service dog, and they do not have public access.
Okay.
Right.
Important distinction. Great.
Correct.
Okay. I think let's try to take one more call here. We're just about out of time here. But hi, you're on Talking Animals. Do you have a question or comment for our panel?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. It is you. Please go ahead.
Okay, quickly, I know a woman who worked for the Department of Blind Services in Tallahassee. She was a supervisor for 20-some years. And her view of this is quite different. She doesn't think that much of the dog situation in general. She just thinks that it's a problem in many different ways, and people don't ever consider it. And she really is concerned because she worked in office with people who had dogs there, and she's a dog owner. She said, you know, the dog's there under a desk all day. How good is that for the dog? And I realize that, they have to be trained a certain way in order to be, you know, useful to human beings. But it seems unfair, in her view, to the dog. And she doesn't think that much of the programs in general. And she has a lot of experience, a lot of field experience and everything else. But it just seems unusual that, you know, we kind of overlook the thing. It's like a, you know, it's like an object rather than an animal. And we have to be careful about that.
So her objection, and it sounds like what you're voicing, is that just the very idea of a dog, even Southeastern guide dog, canine companions, for, you know, a dog that's totally trained and no questions about their legitimacy, that alone they object to.
Well, she had some problems, you know, with them. Her main problem is people, they're trained, you know, and the word trained means that they're controlled. So they're controlled and they're under a desk all day. They're not exercising, not running around or whatever. And the people can say, well, that's the way it is, you know. But her problem with it is that they don't keep the training as such up. They become a pet. You know, they tend to become pets. And so people can't resist that, and it's, you know, you break down their training in some sense, if you want to look at it that way, by being nice to them. You know, it's a conundrum, something that bothered her when she worked there.
Okay.
So I just thought I would bring it up as a counter to some of the, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's great for PTSD people if it makes them, and, you know, there are other things where I think that it makes a lot of sense. It's just that that controlling kind of, subjugation of the animal that is a little disturbing.
Okay, well, thank you for your call, and we have just about a minute or so left. I don't know, in particular, I guess I'd like to hear Linda and perhaps Joanne respond to that, because I think you probably have a lot to say, and I wish we had more time now for which to say
that,
it. But
to me, that's almost the whole program that you could do. Keith is a very willing working dog. He takes great joy in completing the commands, being told that he's a good boy. His tail never stops wagging. And a lot of these things are just fun to do. He's a yellow lab. He likes to retrieve things. This is a game for him. We have a command called release. And when I say release, Keith is out in the yard. He catches frisbees. He is just a dog. So Keith gets a lot of time just being a dog. Plus, he brings great joy to people's lives across the board. I can't tell you what joy he brings people.
Right. I was... go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, I just know Keith as my wonder dog. He is absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I wish we had more time, because as the gentleman was speaking, I thought, well, first of all, any random dog that I know of, at least, has at least a modicum of training, no matter what they're doing. And number two, the legitimate service dogs I'm aware of spend time off the vest or off duty, and some of that time playing with Frisbees, just as you've described, Linda. So, yeah, I guess I'm having a little trouble quite understanding the objection, but it sounds like you're having even more trouble probably, Linda.
Yeah.
Okay, well, gosh, we have reached the end of our time and actually went a little bit over, but I think it was time well spent. So thank you. We've been speaking with Martha Johnson, Joanne Miles, Linda Feld, and Roberta. Thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals and offering all your great input.
That was a pleasure. I learned a lot.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks again. Bye-bye. This is the end of Talking Animals for today. I'll be back next Wednesday, February 10th, alongside my friend and WNF Development Director Laura Taylor, asking for your support of Talking Animals and WNF overall. So go to talkinganimals.net for information about how you can donate earlier, get some spiffy little gifts. And Rob Lori is up next for what amounts to 2 hours of radioactivity. Thanks again for listening. This is WMNF Tampa.